Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. This is a podcast about caves, cave exploration, conservation. If you've been caving before and aren't part of a grotto, I would encourage you to find your local grotto and attend a few meetings. Join up, get involved. Why do we encourage organized caving as opposed to just going caving like you would, say, going on a hike? You don't need to be part of some club to go on a hike. Heck, you could go on a hike by yourself. The difference is that caving, while it's quite safe if you know what you're doing, is decidedly unsafe if you don't know what you're doing. So if you were to lead a trip into a cave having no experience, no helmet, inadequate lights, no map, that's a recipe for disaster. Or a complicated search and rescue, or at the very least, a pretty bad time for everybody, whether you make it out on your own at all. You can very easily get into trouble. Being lost in a cave is very different from being lost in the woods. So the NSS and your local chapter, we call them grottos, exist not only to share caving experiences and findings with each other, but also to educate people on safe caving practices. We don't want people to explore caves unsafely. We want people to explore and enjoy caves. We certainly do that, but we don't want anyone to get hurt, and we don't want to be called out on rescues every other weekend. So we encourage you to join your local grotto and join the NSS. And of course, grottos are also a good way to find new friends who want to go caving. That said, I'm glad you're listening to this podcast. Welcome to it. Whether you're new to caving, curious about caving, or been caving for decades, this is your podcast. It's a monthly podcast, comes out on the first of every month, and I've got a great guest this month in cave historian John Benton. More on that in a bit. Speaking of rescues, in last month's episode, I lamented that I didn't get to do any caving in March. Well, I made up for that in April. I went caving every weekend. And one of those trips was a mock rescue. I did the National Cave Rescue Commission's Orientation to Cave Rescue, a two-day course. Day one is classroom and some outdoor demonstration and practice. Day two is an actual mock rescue in a cave, and it was one of the best experience you could have as a caver. Don Paquette and Anmar Mirza are the gurus of cave rescue, and it was just a very useful experience. The mock rescue was held in Buckner Cave. When we arrived, it was just like a real rescue. We didn't know anything. We didn't know how many people were in the cave, where they were, or anything. So we set up communication. We searched for the patients or potential patients. And when we found them, we assessed their condition, applied first aid, and helped them out. In two of the three cases, the patients were able to make it out on their own with assistance from the rescuers. But one of the patients had to be loaded up into a litter and carried out. And this guy was fairly far in the cave, so we had to figure out how to get him through some tight canyons, uneven terrain, a long crawlway with a tight spot at the end, and we pulled it off. We did it. We did it in time, too. The takeaway from orientation to cave rescue was don't get hurt. Be careful when you're caving. Otherwise, it takes a long time and an awful lot of effort and a ton of manpower to get you out. If you get the chance to take an OCR from the NCRC, do it. And they've got one coming up this weekend in New York State. Not too late to sign up for that one. And one in Kentucky this fall. And, of course, the big week-long national training seminar in Oregon in June. For more, just go to ncrc.info. Well, this past weekend was my last cave trip for a while. And it was a great one. If you've been listening to this podcast, you know that my wife and I are expecting our first child this month. He's due Memorial Day. And so I've decided not to plan anything in the month of May in case he decides to come a little earlier. I'm really excited to be a dad, but I wanted to get in as many trips as I could before the little man gets here. So my grotto, the CIG, was invited by the grottos involved with the Rock Castle Karst Conservancy, the Central Ohio Grotto, Dayton Underground, Greater Cincinnati, Bluegrass Grottos, to cave and party at the Great Saltpeter Cave Preserve near Mount Vernon, Kentucky, where they hold Karstorama every year. Maybe you've been to that. And it was great. RKC just acquired Skylight Dome and Hurricane Pit entrances to Pine Hill Cave. So we planned a bunch of trips in that cave. And the one I went on was the strenuous trip in Skylight Dome and out Hurricane Pit. It was definitely sporty. Some great climbing, tight spots, traverses. But we were only underground about 5 hours, so it was a very enjoyable trip. Sometimes you don't know what you're in for when you sign up for the hard trip, you know. When it's over, you're either really glad that it's over or you're like, eh, that wasn't too bad. And lucky for us, we were in the latter category. It wasn't that bad at all. In fact, it was one of my best trips ever. Then we got back. We had some dinner made by Wendy and Matt and all the good folks who had us out there. And then later that night, we hiked up the hill and did a late night trip through Great Saltpeter Cave, which was an old show cave up until the 70s. And, you know, the lights are still in there. So they turned on the lights and we went through it, led by Wendy Orlandi of the Central Ohio Grotto and Daryl Marsh of the Greater Cincinnati Grotto, who were so passionate about this historic cave, and they shared their knowledge generously as we all walked through. And I don't know if it was the thought that this would be my last cave trip for a while or the thought of carrying my new son through this cave, because it was just such an easy walking tour. You know, you could bring a baby through this cave, but I don't know, I was moved, and I can't wait to go back there. Oh, and it rained off and on the whole time. It was cold. It was just a miserable weekend weather-wise. And that's usually enough to ruin a good weekend, but that's probably the detail that I'll remember the least. I had such a wonderful time, and I want to thank all those people who made it happen. Well, this podcast is sponsored by Swego, and you know Swego as the maker of some of the best cave packs in existence, especially for wet caving, which is pretty much all we have in Indiana. There's some of the only waterproof packs out there, and certainly the best in that category. Of course, due to some supply issues, they had to quit making them in November 2015, but Scott is working on testing out new materials. So far, he hasn't found anything that's up to snuff compared to the material he used to be able to get his hands on. You can follow his progress on the Swego Gear Facebook page. See the test packs, keep up to date, because he's pretty committed to getting Swego packs back on the market. And this past weekend when I was down in Kentucky, I was talking to a bunch of the people there, and I'd say a good portion of the cavers were using their Swego packs, at least a quarter of the people there. And we had a good amount of people were using Swego packs. And so we're standing around the fire and shooting the breeze and talking gear and a bunch of other things. And this is what I love about this Swego sponsorship. Scott lets me pretty much say whatever I want, whatever I want about Swego. And lucky for him, I like Swego and would never say a bad word about it. But I will say this. The consensus around the fire was that people want their Swego packs back. And several of the people I talked to said they would buy another Swego, if not two or three, when they came back in the market. They would pay more money, you know, they would pay more. You know, Swegos, I think, were priced pretty affordably for what they are and the amount of work and design that went into them. So, Scott, the support is there. Once you figure this thing out, you won't be able to make them fast enough. Now, in the meantime, it's important to support his efforts by buying his other products. Chicken loops, little webbing loops you can put around your feet to drag packs through crawlways. They can also assist in climbing and rope work. They're only $5 each and available in three sizes. Rope traps, like a Chinese finger trap, but for your rope. Good for pulling rope through pulleys. He sells those. Sight lights and sight light shields for your nice Sunto compasses and clinometers. They not only protect your expensive survey gear, but they glow in the dark. And those sight lights can help you take your reading with one hand without shining a separate light on the face so you can see. And of course, fun stickers like the Swego logo and the No Not, No Not sticker. Support the podcast by supporting our sponsor, Swego. Order direct at swegogear.com. That's Swego, S-W-A-Y-G-O, gear.com. Okay, a quick calendar note before we get to John. I forgot to mention this last month, but I got to plug my grotto's big event, Indiana Cave Capers, August 4th through the 6th, the first weekend in August, Harrison County Fairgrounds, which is pretty much downtown Corydon. No excuses. GPS will get you there. This is one for the whole family. Downtown Corydon has great restaurants and shops. It's beautiful in and around Corydon. You don't have to just come for caving. But we do have some of the best caves in Indiana down there. They're just over the hill. In fact, our longest cave, Binkley's, has an entrance right on the property, the Fairgrounds Spring entrance. Now, I wouldn't recommend entering the cave there because it's wet and often pretty close to being sumped, but it's possible. Anyway, the CIG has been doing cave capers over 60 years now, and we know that this year's is going to be one of the best ones yet. We're going to have a ton of trips going into Binkley's for all skill levels, plenty of other trips to some of the other caves around there. So put it on the calendar, and I hope to see you there. I am the chairman of the CIG, and my wife and son will be there, so I'll probably be manning the registration most of the time. So I can't wait to meet you. Make plans to come to Indiana in August. We've got some great caves and good times planned. We'll see you there. Okay, wow, enough from me. Thanks for sitting through the intro. Let's hand it over to cave historian John Benton, one of the first guests ever suggested to me via email, given it was his son who suggested. Thank you, Nick. But John was so nice to come all the way up to my house in Indy to chat, and we had a great talk. Cave historian John Benton. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing good. Doing great.
Welcome to the Caving Podcast. So you just showed me a photo of your first wild cave trip. It's an old photo in your collection. And how old were you?
4 years old.
Four. Right. 1956?
Correct.
Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was a big day. And you said you haven't been. Which cave was that?
It's Tabor's Cave in southern Harrison County.
And you haven't been back since?
I've not been back to it. Dave Black and some other cavers have, and it's on my bucket list to do yet.
That's marvelous. So let's go back to the beginning after the beginning. So that was the beginning. And so obviously that, would you say that trip made a big impression on you, or were you too little to kind of know?
I was probably too little then. Like I say, four years old, I was with two older brothers, but I really didn't get into it. In high school is when I got started. I'm from Corydon, so I grew up right there in the cave area, and friends and neighbors had caves and holes on their farms and property, and got in with ISS in 1969 was my first venture out with them. The ISS had already been at it for a couple of years, so I was a latecomer in 1969 to the ISS. But they'd already been involved and started in Binkley's, and my first trip went to Blowing Hole Cave with them.
Which is part of Binkley's
part
now.
Of Binkley's
as
now.
Of just a few years ago, yeah, we determined the connection.
Right. We didn't know it then, suspected, but yeah. It took quite a few years to finally connect it, so... It was in the wintertime. It was like a January, February trip. And
did you slide across the ice in the entrance? Is that how you did? Okay. Yes. Yeah. I've heard of that being done there.
It was my first experience with the ice in Blowing Hole and no wetsuits.
So it was sucking air in at that time.
It was. Yeah. In the wintertime. Yeah.
Yeah. So it pulls the cold air in, freezes the ice right beyond the entrance. And you kind of got to just.
It makes it nice, really, because you can kind of skate through if it's frozen solid in that. First couple hundred feet.
Isn't it on your belly?
No.
I haven't been in, so I don't really know.
It's hands and knees for the most part.
Hands and knees, okay.
Hands and knees for the most part, yeah. Yeah.
But it pulls in enough air to where you're not really, depending on, I guess, how cold it is outside, you're not really in danger of falling through the ice. It's thick enough, right, to...
Well, it can be. I've seen times when it's not that thick, but it's the water's not that deep either. It's maybe... 6 to 12 inches deep.
Oh, it's not bad.
And you can kind of stay out of it if you straddle it, so you're not immersed in it. But you don't want to spend, as cold as it is, sucking air in, you don't want to spend any extra time there if you don't have to. So,
man, all right. So that didn't scare you off then?
No, it didn't. Like I say, I was hooked from then on. Louis Lehman was the godfather of Indiana caving right there in Corydon, had the hardware store. And my dad knew Louis. Actually, Louis's the one that signed me up for the NSS. Back then you had to have a member sponsor you.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
At the time. And Louis was, my dad had gone caving with Louis some and, over the years, but Louis was the main, if you had a cave to check out in Harrison County or Corydon, you got a hold of Louis Lehman.
And he knew.
Louis took me early on quite a few trips, and that's how I got started in organized caving, more or less. So,
what's the grotto that you belong to down there?
Well, it's Harrison Crawford is kind of inactive now. Mm-hmm. Louisville Grotto is the closest.
Yeah.
But they don't do a whole lot on, you know, on the Indiana side. Mm-hmm. But so
you sort of have loose affiliations with nearby organizations. Mm-hmm.
And then once I got I went to IU eventually later in college, and the BIG was there. And loosely affiliated with several Grottos, really. So, mm-hmm.
So Blowing Hole was, you said that was kind of the first serious foray into caving?
Right. That's when I had, got into wild caving pretty much and joined the NSS back then when I was still in high school. That's when I got started.
How did the path to cave historian sort of begin? I mean, did you just notice that you had sort of begun to collect all these things, and you're just and it was just kind of like, okay, well, let's pursue this.
I guess it did. My dad had a few postcards that he had over the years from laying around in a drawer. I mean, it really wasn't a collection per se, but Wyandotte, Marengo Cave postcards. And my mom always told a story that I never knew my grandfather on my mom's side, but he had actually, they lived in New Albany. That's where she was from.
Huh?
And 1925, my grandfather had gone down to, by train on Carnival Sunday when Floyd Collins was being rescued and,
oh, wow,
in the media. So
yeah,
he had been there. Like I say, he passed away before I was born or soon after, so I never knew him. But he actually had an old 33 RPM record of the Ballad of Floyd Collins. And mom always talked about that trip that he had made and talked about. Of course, you know, it's kind of a combination of things. I grew up in the cave area and surrounded by little tidbits like that, that just became more interested as time went along. So,
yeah, had a good foundation to kind of get you going on it.
Yeah.
So let's then move through the caving career. So you got into Blowing Hole, and then when you started seriously getting involved with the ISS, what were some of the projects that you helped work on? Of course, Binkley, I would imagine.
Binkley, and we did a lot in Harrison Crawford area, just, you know, different holes here and there, surveyed quite a few of them. There's old editions of the ISS news out there that published several maps and surveys. This was back in the 70s and 80s for the most part. You know, always stayed interested in caving. I got a summer job while I was in college working at Wyandotte as a guide, and enjoyed that immensely.
Yeah, I would imagine getting paid to hang out in this cave all day.
That's right.
And tell everybody about it. Are you excited about Wyandotte reopening, or do you have any information on that? Because it seems like, what was it, last July they had a day where it was open.
Yeah. And they were open weekends starting last summer. And from what I understand, they'll be opening again Memorial Day or around Memorial Day. And I'm not sure if they're going to be open every day, but Friday, Saturday, Sunday, that's what they did last summer.
And there were a number of reasons why it closed. I mean, White Nose was the big one. And I think that there was a money issue too. I mean, the sort of visitor center was not in the best shape.
Right.
And so the state was just like, look, we've got this WNS problem. We've got some money shortages. Let's just close this down for a little while. And now it's coming back up, and it's pretty wonderful because it's a beautiful cave.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, I don't know if you've ever been in Wyandotte, but it's
still on my list.
Huge passage for an Indiana cave. It's different. It's really spectacular. Huge dry passageway for the most part. The large rooms, and there's probably still a lot there to be found.
Yeah,
down the road. So
yeah, that's exciting. Is there anything in Harrison Crawford, in Indiana, or period, that discovery wise that you can really put your name on as far as being there when it was surveyed or when it was found? Any digs where you found some big cave?
Yeah. Was in, probably the longest single chunk of cave was the Millennium Passage that we got into in upstream Binkley's. The Harvey's entrance, or the historic entrance to Binkley's, you go down, and everybody always went downstream, but you know, we knew it had to continue upstream. So back, I think we started in 1998 or 99, we started doing, you know, having moving rocks and trying to get upstream. And it was I've got it. It's documented, but 18 or 19 trips into the cave to move enough rocks and we could finally break through. And we got into what we called the Millennium Passage in late 2000. And it turned out the first survey, once we broke through the initial survey trip was 4,400 feet. Whew. In one day.
So that was in Binkley too. So it must have been fairly easy to move through once you got into it.
Once you, going through that crawlway restriction, a lot of breakdown, but once you're through there, it opens up and, almost all that 4,400 feet was walking passage.
Now, wow.
A lot of it was suck mud and not real easy walking, but it was.
Well, that's Binkley for you.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things last month when I talked to Gary, and I'll ask you the same thing. I mean, for Binkley being the longest cave in the state, I mean, isn't it a shame that it's just so hard to get through sometimes?
Yeah. It's not the easiest, that's for sure.
But if you've done some serious work in Binkley, I mean, that's kind of a badge of honor because it's not the easiest cave.
It's not, but, it's you earn the badge, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
There definitely are, and the nice thing about that, the dig where we started was you could be there in 10 minutes from the top of the hill, inside the entrance. So it wasn't like some sections of Binkley where you have to go 4 hours to get there,
yeah,
and then you start your work.
There are some far-flung areas of Binkley Cave and more to come, I'm sure. But just the amount of time that some of these guys spend down there is just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just some major work still being done there. Do you think you'll ever see the end of Binkley Cave?
I hope not.
I hope not too.
Hope it keeps on going. There's a lot of leads still to be checked out, and they just were in Dewey Eckert Pit here the other week, I guess, and
mm-hmm.
found. I guess it went over the 44-mile mark now.
Officially, it was so close for the longest time.
Yep.
Now we're finally there, and they knew it was going to get there. Of course.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know where the end is really. It there could be breakthroughs that always getting slow chunks here and there, but there could be some big bust out sections where. There's a lot miles of cave still left. So.
Well, now the big frontier in Binkley, isn't it to the southeast?
Well, that's
McLean River Passage.
That's probably the big one, but going toward east towards New Middletown and more due south, there's a lot of sinkhole plain that should be cave under that still haven't gotten into.
Shoot.
So yeah, there's a lot.
Okay, so when you talk cave history. What do you work primarily in? Are you not picky, or do you focus primarily on Indiana? I know that you've got a book out on Floyd Collins.
Yeah, just came out. Indiana and Kentucky are my two main concentration areas.
Mm-hmm.
If I see something interesting from a cave from another state or area, I'll definitely.
It's hard to talk cave history and not talk about Kentucky.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's the same limestone, really.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at it, it starts, near Bloomington and crosses the Ohio River and runs down through Kentucky to Tennessee. So it's all in the same limestone belt. So,
mm-hmm.
But the Indiana and Kentucky areas have been my main core of concentration.
And what is it about it? I mean, as a caver, I can understand, I think, what it is because it's just fun to learn about it and learn the history and to write and talk about it. I can imagine that's probably what it is for you.
Yeah, it is.
Easy write, an easy thing to kind of draw from.
What amazes me about it, I think, is just all the ways people have used caves over the years or the link to the past. Not only recent history with, Floyd Collins, that was 1925 when he died in Sand Cave in Kentucky, but the prehistoric Indians, they were roaming around in the caves with torches 5,000 years ago.
So you go that far back. I mean, you're talking anthropology and stuff too.
Yeah,
sometimes.
I mean, I'm not an anthropologist by any means,
sure,
but I like to study the people who the anthropologists and paleontologists that do study that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in collecting and looking at their work. And there's been a lot of that in Wyandotte, in Mammoth Cave, and smaller caves in the area. It's It's amazing. They must have had to have lived back in that time, and they must have had a direct pathway that the prehistoric Indians, between Mammoth and Wyandotte and several caves in between, they just kind of made the circuit. You know, would have been very interesting to know more about that.
Yeah.
How all that, you know, to even have gone in a cave 5,000 years ago with a torch, you know, I'm not so sure I'd want to try that, but they did.
Well, knowing what we know, of course.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that none of them have been as far back as any of us have with our modern gear and things like that.
Well, know? No, but it's amazing the some of the areas they did go into in Wyandotte and in Mammoth, and there's Turner Cave in Kentucky is a privately owned cave, but really only discovered maybe 15, 20 years ago that a wealth of prehistoric artifacts and things they've found in there, so.
Didn't Ken talk about that on a previous episode?
Probably. I'm sure Ken's been there. So.
I think he helped with
because that. Glenn Turner is the owner, and
So what are some of the more fascinating things you found out in your quest for cave history?
Like I say, the different uses that people have had. You know, I mean, caves have been used for dance halls, mushroom farms. Onion tried to grow onions. There's an area in Wyandotte where they tried to grow onion sets.
How? Well, I guess they probably weren't particularly successful. But
No. I don't know if, no sunlight, no water.
No.
So. But I don't know what they were thinking. But the onion set, some of the onion sets are still there, and it's a dry, dusty passageway.
Wow.
And
maybe it wasn't at the time. The remnants, who knows?
Yeah. So, counterfeiters have tried to use or did use caves in years past. Really, a lot of the stuff that people just do above ground, they've done in caves too, or tried to do in caves over the years. And then caves to show caves to let the general public in to see a lot of those areas where we as cavers get to go a lot is really amazing. The underground boat rides and some of the formations and just huge passageways. And it's, the nature part of the caves really has always appealed to me. And, it all goes together with the history and the biology and the geology and, all the ologies. So mentioned the Millennium Passage, but another neat cave, a lot shorter cave, is, Rand Hazlett and I found, We were going to go to Binkley's. We had met one evening up at Corydon, and it was a late winter, early spring day, and there's a lot of ice around, so we didn't go to Binkley's, canceled that trip. But we ended up going in, this was when you had access to the state-owned caves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cave, ended up, we called it 1915 Cave in the Harrison Crawford Forest. It's a small hole I had seen. And so Rand and I were the only two, I don't know, six or eight of us met, but Rand and me were the only two that ended up going there that night. And we dug a little bit on the entrance and got inside the cave. And it turned out, we thought it was virgin, but there's a very faint 1915 was scratched on the wall. So somebody had been there before us.
Nothing else, just the date?
Just the date. Well, I think there might have been some initials. I've forgotten now what the initials are, but it was, to find that. And it's small cave, not a lot of footage, but just a small room that was really loaded with formations. Really neat.
Ah, that's so cool. That must have been really, really cool to find and to think that it's virgin.
Yeah. And, I mean, it, all appearances, we thought we were at first until we got to looking around. Might have even been we didn't even find the initials on the first trip.
And obviously it's filled in over the years.
It had, yeah.
To the point where, it's changed a lot and somebody got in there back in 1915.
Yep.
You got to wonder how many of those virgin caves are actually virgin when they're found and dug open. And, maybe they just filled in and maybe somebody poked around in there a long time ago and didn't leave any clue.
Right. Yeah.
Let's talk about the book. What's the title of the book?
The Tragedy at Sand Cave. It's about Floyd Collins. It's myself and two other cavers, Bill Napper from Louisville and Bob Thompson up by Cincinnati, got together and put this out. It just came out at the end of February. But it's, you know, there's been several books written about Floyd Collins over the years. Roger Brucker and William Halliday have written fine books on it. But ours is more of a pictorial. We accessed a lot of the old black and white photos from different collectors. Gordon Smith, National Cave Museum, was a great help there. Mm-hmm. He's got probably the world's biggest collection of cave memorabilia. So we went to, you know, he was very generous in letting us copy and duplicate a lot of his collection. And there were several other cavers that contributed stuff that and we just had to feed all the information to our publisher and do the text work and captions. So it's been several months in the making, but it's out now and ended up a good job, I think. So
yeah, and like you said, there's a lot of stuff out there on Floyd Collins, and there's no shortage of information that you can right. find. But I think just glancing at yours, if you want a good, solid overview of the incident, the media circus that followed, yeah. and everything else, I mean, you could get through that book in a good, solid afternoon, I think.
Yeah, because a lot of it's, you're just a small amount of text. It's mostly, you know, a pictorial,
yeah.
old black and white pictures reproduced. So, yeah.
It's an excellent...
it's not a novel that you're going to sit down and...
No.
Read for 3 days.
So. No, but that's great, I think, for people who are just looking for something to do on a rainy afternoon.
Some more information on it.
You can get it on Amazon, I'm sure.
Yeah, Amazon or I'm sure the major booksellers like Barnes & Noble, you could order it. Some of the Louisville area bookstores are carrying it and stocking it. And I think like Diamond Caverns and I'm not sure, Marengo Cave, Indiana Caverns is supposed to carry it. Have it available. So yeah, it's readily available. It should be.
What are some caves that you are never going to get bored with visiting? And you always love going back.
Right. Wyandotte would have to be at the top of the list there.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Binkley's, but I'm not a huge fan of mud. you know, I'll put
and
up with it. I'll
and
put
yet
up
in
with
the
it.
Same sentence, you said, I like Binkley's.
So, yeah, I mean, one kind of, you know, you can't like it and one, it goes with it. But yeah, Wyandotte is a dry, dusty passage and, you know, you can walk for hours and nooks and crannies and side passages. And, even though there's what I think Wyandotte is close to 10 miles altogether in surveyed passage, which I've not seen a fair amount of that even, but, yeah, there's, I never get tired of Wyandotte. Marengo's another nice cave, just, you know.
Not as long.
Formations outstanding, just you know, amazing, really. Jewel Box Cave's another one it's inside the Harrison Crawford Forest. It's one of the caves that are closed now due to the white nose, but hopefully one day it will be open again to cavers, and it's got, there's one, it's not a real large cave, but just from beginning to end, it's packed with formations.
Wow.
And there's one area where there are soda straws that you can kind of duck under. It's a small room, but you can get under and look up, and there's hundreds, or if not thousands, of soda straw stalactites hanging down from above. And they're 18 inches long. It's just incredible.
Got to be careful in that room.
Yeah. I mean, the cave is gated, but it'd be nice if cavers could have access to it again, but maybe one of these days. So.
And Wyandotte is cool. And again, I'm only speaking from hearing about it because I've actually never been in, but I mean, Wyandotte's one of those caves too, where if you want to get to some of the farther flung areas, I mean, you do have to do a little bit of work.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You can do the tourist trip or you can do the caver trip, and the caver trip comes with its own huge rewards.
Yeah. Yeah. The state just this past year hasn't done it, but back when it was privately owned, they had, well, and when the state ran it too, before 2009, you could have their wild cave trips was actually the Rothrock family back in they called it the 5-hour trip, which went to the Pillar Constitution, a huge stalagmite.
Still have to see.
And then they called it the 8-hour trip, the all day trip, but that was kind of a lot of zigzagging. It wasn't really an 8-hour trip, but it turned into one.
Sure.
there's a lot of old historic names and dates in Wyandotte too. That's one thing I enjoy in there is looking at those. A lot of them, you know, the 1800s, a lot mm-hmm. of 1800 and early 1900 signature dates that are still in there. They're historic now, not graffiti.
yeah. 100 years ago, they may have been considered graffiti, but as right. long as they're still there today. Yep. Isn't that interesting, though? I mean, I think that there's just so much graffiti that proliferates today that 100 years from now, is that going to be considered historic?
That's a good question.
You know, because some of it's vulgar, some of it's just ugly. Yeah. You know, you got this unnatural orange
spray paint,
as opposed to you know some candle residue or whatever it is that you'll see with an 1800s date on it. You know, there's to us that's ugly and unsightly. But how are people going to feel 100 years from now?
I mean that's a good question, and you know it's. If it's 50 years old or 100 years old, it's considered historic. Well, mm-hmm. that's true, but the day after it was written, it was not 100 years old.
No.
It's so do you remove it if it's brand new? It's, you know, but I guess you have to draw the line somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the spray paint, that's graffiti as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. It's just an interesting thing to think about. So what would you say, and I know you're a cave historian, so I want to focus mainly on that, but I also want to talk about John Benton, the caver. What would you say is the grimmest, grimiest situation you've ever found yourself in a cave that just didn't seem like it was ever going to end? Something that made you question your hobby.
Yeah. The peanut butter passage in Binkley's comes to mind.
I knew you were going to say Binkley.
Aptly named the peanut butter passage, although it's...
I can picture it.
it's named for the mud that you're laying down in trying to advance.
So it's a crawlway.
It's a crawlway. Yep. There hasn't been too many trips there over the years.
Just enough to get the survey shots, exactly. And then we're never coming back.
Probably without backsights, too. It's, we were always accused of not taking backsights in a lot of Binkley's that maybe we should have, but circumstances dictated not taking them sometimes. You wanted to get out of there. So.
Well, let me take you back there. So what was it like? I mean, I'm sure you don't want to remember it. Maybe you've blocked some of it out of your mind, but how much time did you spend in there and what was it like? How long was it?
I mean, it wasn't like a 15-hour trip or anything like that. It was just,
it was
probably only maybe a 3 or 4 hour trip total in and out, but still the time that you were there was not enjoyable. And, I remember we were trying to, get through, enlarge the passage, and we had cookie sheets that you put them. Somebody up front would have the trowel try and put the peanut butter mud on the cookie sheet, pass it back.
So it was an awful dig.
Yeah, that. Yeah. Oh, and the guy in the back tried to dump the cookie sheet, and it wouldn't even come off of the cookie sheet without taking your whole hand and shoving it off and then passing the empty tray back up.
So were you in the front doing the digging at one point? You guys took shifts?
We took turns. Yeah. We took turns.
Gosh.
So,
so it was tight too. Tight and disgusting.
It was a belly crawl, but it wasn't super low. I mean, you know, it was kind of in between a belly crawl and a
any kind of a crawl in that kind of mud is not any fun.
Right. But you're up out of the water you're the water passage was down below you, the next level. So
did you get down in there to rinse off afterward?
Definitely. Yeah. That's a Dave Everton, thing. You know, he has to take his bath in the cave before he comes out. So,
when was, your most recent long, long trip?
Well, let's see, define long, long, I guess it's,
I would say over 8 hours.
That may have been the Millennium Passage, exploring that around. It's been quite a few years since I've gone on a long, long multi-hour trip that.
They're not easy.
And as you get older, that's another reason I get more interested in the history. You know, you can stay involved in the caving, but you don't have to go on the 18-hour trips either to stay involved. So
yeah,
So it's been a few years since I've been on one that long. So, you know, it's probably been the Millennium Passage when we were working on that. So,
and that kept you sore for a few days.
Oh yeah.
I just did my longest trip recently, went up to the Rise in Sullivan, and that was a bear. Have you ever been up there?
No, not that far in Sullivan. So
it's interesting.
You know, it's funny.
But it was a good experience.
Like Sullivan's Cave, and well, the caves of Monroe County, and even Bedford area. We always joked that was too far north for us to go caving. You know, we were down in Harrison Crawford.
It's enough down here. We don't need to go way up there.
There was plenty to do without going up north to go caving. So, you know, it's all perspective. So,
do you still have any? Do you still have any carbide in your house?
Yes. I don't know when the last time it was used.
Yeah, but it's still there, and it'll probably still work. And
I've got several carbide lights that either I used or had collected over the years, but it's been a long time since I had one in a cave. So
sure,
you know, I didn't go, but I think some of the Evansville grotto people had a carbide cave trip only that a few years ago, and occasionally, you know, some grottos will have those. But
do you find that you still have your carbide reflexes even with the new LEDs and stuff? Like, you don't want to put your hand too close to your helmet or anything like that? Because I've heard of guys who say that they just can't shake that, and some of them can, you know.
I think I've gotten over that.
Okay, good.
But definitely did probably for, you know, at first, but it's, you know, switched over from carbide. That was another thing going into Binkley's with carbide. You know, you couldn't see anything really.
I couldn't imagine you could.
You were very limited. What you might see 5 or 6 feet in front of you, but if you were in any size passageway, it just didn't show up. You know, we thought we were in a whole new different cave once we got electric lights and started trips with those. So
yeah, I can't imagine. I can't imagine. I mean, but there is a quality to carbide that you just can't get from anything else. It's just that sort of soft glow.
Right, kind of a warm, soft light. Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it'll provide some heat, too, if you get chilled in the cave and want to just a couple of degrees difference. Makes all the difference sometimes. So
I just can't imagine, though, being in Binkley and using carbide, because there is always the risk of it being doused by water and stuff, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And there's no shortage of water in Binkley.
It was, you know, early on, that was the standard. So that's what everyone used. So then times evolved, thank goodness. So
thank goodness.
Never would have got to 40 miles plus without different lighting. So, well, one place I'd like to see that I haven't been to is that, my son Nick was found was via the Blowing Hole side. Now it is Benton, what's called Benton Boulevard off Blowing Hole.
Named by your son.
Well, he was, I think, I'm not sure who was with him on that trip, whether it was Tim McLean or maybe Pride, or Shane Mile, one of those. Anyhow, the name got Benton Boulevard got on the map. So I've never been there. I'd like to see that one of these days. So maybe with, you know, the new entrance on the, Deep Darkness that Gary has, that he takes his wild cave trips down. That's the easiest way to that now, I think. So
yeah,
that maybe he's a doable trip here down the road the next couple of years or less. So
got to see the passage named after you.
Exactly.
You got to see it. It's not like you can get by with not going there. How much caving? I mean, there was no shortage of activity down in Corydon. I mean, there's no shortage of being able to, you know, visit any number of caves at any time, especially in the days when you could go through Harrison Crawford State Forest.
Oh, yeah, definitely. When you had access to all those, because there's 25,000 acres there in Harrison Crawford State Forest.
And so it's just covered in caves.
Almost. Well, all of it has caves on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all limestone. So,
but when you did venture away from home, what did you enjoy? I mean, you went down to Kentucky. What did you like to do down in there?
The Mammoth area, you know, it's only a couple hours away from where we lived in southern Indiana. But I went on several of the restoration field camps that they would have at Mammoth, you know, cleanups in, inside Mammoth, and they still have those. I haven't been to one for a while, but and then a current project I've just gotten involved with, some cavers, actually Tennessee cavers, Joe Douglas and Marion Smith, yeah. Kristen Bobo. Years ago, they got started documenting Civil War names and dates inside, found inside caves. Mainly, they started in Georgia and Tennessee and Alabama, but they've evolved now. They're working the Mammoth area, and I've been on a couple of trips with them to look for some Civil War names and dates. And I haven't been in Mammoth with them, although that's, you know, all the area caves down there they're trying to take a look at. And we actually found three Civil War names in Indian Cave, which is right there in the Mammoth Cave area, just a few weekends ago.
What a perfect project for you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of cavers will know Gerald Mone. He was long on the trip with him and Marion are two cavers of a classic kind, you might say. So
you might say.
So that was enjoyable. And something else is kind of an ongoing deal that's fired up again is trying to document all the old and former show caves of Mammoth Cave area. You know, Mammoth Cave was the big dog and still is. But over the years, there's been as many as, right now we've got at least 47 or 48 different caves entrances. Some of them were the same caves, just different entrances.
Sure.
That were used showing as a show cave. Now, some of them were, most of those 47 were not profitable and only existed maybe months, if that.
A lot of competition in that area.
So you know, the history on those is scarce and far between. But some had postcards, some had a brochure, and just trying to collect and find all that history. That's something that's ongoing right now that involved with. So
I would imagine there's a lot to put together there.
Oh yeah. It's, you know, in the same cave might have five or six different names. There's one cave that definitely had five different names over, you know, depending on time period or who you asked or whatever. So
sure.
It's confusing.
And down there too, it's still got to be ongoing and we'll never see the end of that either.
No, I'm sure we won't.
And not to mention just that, but also the historical significance. I mean, you can keep digging there too.
Oh yeah. There's tons of Mammoth, you know, cave information that, you know, people like Stan Sides, Norman Warnell are digging up for stuff all the time. Just new stuff that people didn't know about. So,
wow. And,
yeah. It's amazing.
So I like to ask everybody this, and some people have a hard time answering because they just can't imagine doing anything else. But what do you think it is about caves or caving that you like? Like, why do you do it?
It's something different that the average person doesn't get to do. And I've always enjoyed nature and studying history and something that Louis Lehman, when I first started caving, you know, he always told me that stuck with me. And he says, and people would come into his hardware store and, you know, Louis, why do you go in those caves? They'd ask him. He goes, yeah, he says, I like to go in caves. And he paused a little bit and he says, and I like to come out of them too.
isn't that the case?
So it's, you know, it's a good break or, you know, not really a break, but just,
relief. Some people see it as a meditation because you got to concentrate on what you're doing. You got to remember you are. You got to look behind you. You got to, you know.
Yeah. It's cavers aren't daredevils. You know, they're not thrill seekers, maybe to a degree, but.
Yeah, some of them got to be, but.
To do all the precautions is the point. You're right. That's one of the big drives for me has always been and to potentially see areas that no human being has ever seen before. And you're the first one there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of areas, you're one of the very few that ever will be there ever.
Yeah. So like the peanut butter passage, not that there's a point of pride there, but
exactly.
Well, and I think even if you've been somewhere that hundreds, if not thousands, if not even hundreds of thousands, when you're talking about like Buckner or show caves or things like that, you go somewhere that's really hard to get to, even then the sense of accomplishment there is something else.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's just, like climbing a mountain. I mean, you know, you're at the top. Of course, in the cave, you never know when you're at the top.
No,
no, or what's around the next corner. Part of the adventure.
That is part of the adventure. And it's, and I think fighting back nerves, which are completely natural to have.
I mean,
it's natural for anyone, no matter their experience level, to get claustrophobia sometimes. It can come on to you, and to fight that off. It is a total experience and a total commitment to do it. And it's something that once you got the bug, and you've done enough, you got to keep going back and experiencing it.
Charlie Fort, an old Louisville caver, he's passed away now, but went on some trips years ago with him to Tennessee. The Cumberland Caverns would have their Christmas party, and they don't have it anymore there in Tennessee, but it was for a cavers only Christmas party. And Charlie would always, he was famous for, he said, "We're going to have a TLA, True Life Adventure." And it, you know, it was from A to Z what it was going to involve, but you can imagine it was going to be, you were going somewhere, might be in a cave or a hike or to see a waterfall, but you always had TLAs. So.
True Life Adventure. Oh, that's grand. Have you done any other books?
Not books. I've written a lot of articles for, you know, Grotto newsletters and journal. There's a history section of the NSS, the American Spelian History Association. They've got a journal of Spelian history, but no other books, no other books. So
here's a question. So what does your home display look like? Your home area where you keep all this stuff? I mean, is it more or less just kind of a haphazard archive, or do you have anything on display proudly shown to the public or whoever might be coming in?
Nothing really on display.
Yeah.
Organized disorganization, maybe.
Organized chaos. There you go.
I mean, I've got a lot of stuff that, you know, and I slowly am going through and sorting it, and you know, that's an ongoing process.
It's an ongoing, constant thing, I'm sure.
You think you make headway, and then all of a sudden here's another box, another crate, plastic tub of brochures or whatever that, needs. And my wife kind of gets on my case, because, if I see anything in a newspaper or in a newspaper I've got about caves, I've got to clip it out and save it. And then how do I file it so I can find it later? So it's, you know.
You wake up one day and, look at all this stuff.
Yeah,
all right, well,
exactly.
Yeah. And I imagine that's how you kind of got to that point, too. You just, it was something you were into. Mm-hmm. You began collecting things and amassing things, and then all of a sudden, you're a cave historian.
Yeah.
Is that kind of how it happened?
Yeah,
it
I didn't start out to be a cave historian,
of course,
I guess.
Not.
It just kind of evolved, and then you're there one day.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I don't know if you're aware or not, but Gordon Smith at Diamond Caverns, outside of their privately owned cave that they own outside of Mammoth with his partners, he's building the National Cave Museum.
I was aware of that. And I actually tried to get him on. He wasn't interested, but maybe having you and Gary on here, I'll get him.
But the building has started there for the cave museum. And like I say, he's by far has the largest collection of cave memorabilia of anyone. So
I've heard about his collection.
It's amazing. And he's very generous as far as, you know, for cavers, if you're interested or looking for specific information, letting you copy or make copies accessible for cavers as whatever information they're looking at. Because, you know, if need people like that, because that kind of stuff will be lost like any history if somebody doesn't collect it. So, mm-hmm.
Going back to why you do it, do you think that nowadays it's, I wouldn't say important, like we're not pushing this on anybody, but I feel like we might end up seeing a surge in interest in caving because it is such a departure from reality. And these days, everyone's on their phones constantly.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And And people really need an intense experience to kind of get them away from their everyday life. And if you have the nerve to handle it, because not everybody does, as you know, caving, I think, is a perfect way to get away from it all.
To escape that. Yeah, it could be. I mean, I don't know how down the road, I'm sure there'll be people looking for ways to escape, like you say, and get into something like caving. Caving is kind of, there seems like there's less cavers now than there were years ago. You go to a lot of caver functions now and everybody's 50 years old or older, the majority of people there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think part of that is the white nose, you know, that a lot, so much of the cave area was off limits or has been, that just didn't create as much interest as would have been there because of that. And hopefully that can come back. And you brought up a funny thought too. If you want to really get a strange caver reaction inside a cave, take an old cell phone along. You're a mile back in the passage, flip your cell phone out, act like you're getting a call and start talking and watch the reaction.
You get service down here?
Yeah. That was the exact question.
Well, it's a Nokia 3310, so I mean, I can get service anywhere.
Walkie-talkies will work in caves.
Yeah, they will.
And certain areas anyhow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good way to establish a connection.
Yeah, for cave radioing, we've successfully used those in different Binkleys and different over the years, different locations. So.
Yeah, and I've heard of people using walkie-talkies to call off rope on long drops too.
Yeah.
That's a big drop if that's what you're doing. Speaking of which, how's your vertical? You do a lot or a little or not
I do.
Much?
I don't do much vertical.
No?
Never have.
No.
Just wasn't my interest. I've done very limited vertical, but if there's not some horizontal at the bottom of the vertical for me,
what's the point?
Yeah. I've kind of taken some ribbing from cavers over the years about that. But, I always said, if God would have intended me to go in this cave, and you put some horizontal passage at the bottom. So, and otherwise, no, don't go see it. It just never was a big interest for me. So,
not so much the fear of heights as it is.
No, not really.
Just there's nothing down there to go walk and do.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah. I've heard from so many people who once they get into vertical, almost ends up being all they do.
I know. There's people that Elliot Stahl and different people like him that. Bounce the pit or don't do it. Don't do anything. So.
And if you've done it already, don't go back. So you've also done a lot of work with the ICS, Indiana Cave Survey.
Well, yeah. Although really just within the last couple of years. The ICS has been around for, I guess, 25 or 30 years. But I've really only become involved with them probably the last 3 years or so.
And to just kind of get the wealth of information kind of organized?
Yeah, I mean, it's for Indiana, it's a central repository for the cave locations, the cave, and everything that's known about. I mean, if it's mapped, if it's surveyed, who discovered it, and like I say, actual location, and then Keith Dunlap's done a great job the last few years putting all the print or all the historic print media that is known about Indiana caves, the old newsletters, the IKC updates, but then the old grottos that didn't, that no longer exist. Like, there were old Tell City Grotto, the Scotto Grotto, Washington, Indiana had one, but they had a grotto newsletter at one time. There's a e-library site as part of the ICS website that you can go to once you're a member and look up all these old newsletters in one central location. And it's really a great resource.
Yeah.
A lot of cavers aren't aware that, that information's out there in one place. But like I say, it's not accessible to anyone because, there again, it's the locations and everything.
Sure,
and
sure.
It's,
that's sensitive information.
Exactly. It's not information that you want anybody to be able to access.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of cave locations in the state that still, I mean, there may be a reference from it. Dick Blends years ago started probably the first Indiana cave list. And that was before GPSs and, all the, so many of the are just mentioned and, you know, are lost. They've been lost now and nobody knows where they're at. So a lot of it's just going back and trying to find these entrances that did exist or should exist, or maybe they've collapsed in and don't exist anymore.
Huh.
So I've kind of, it's a good way to, you know, there again, doesn't involve hours and hours, on a trip, but, try and find some of these old entrances from the information that's there. And sometimes you're successful, sometimes not, but, you know, if you can find it, get a GPS location on it or a topo map, you know, quarter location. And also Keith's trying to, put a, entrance photo of every cave that we've got
documented. So you can be sure you got the right one.
And there's a lot of them that still don't have pictures. They may be documented and have a location, but so I, you know, with a smartphone, it's easy to just go around and once you find the entrance, just get an, you know, even the closed caves on state land, you can go up to the entrance and get a picture of the entrance.
So sure.
That's, what I spent a fair amount of time doing, the last few years since I've become involved with the ICS, and any caver really can if, once you become a member. So, you know, they have quarterly meetings, but you really don't, you don't have to attend any of the meetings if you don't want to. What some cavers don't like, and you have to have, you sign up as an associate member, and I think dues are only $5 a year.
Wow.
So that's nothing, but, you've got to be an associate member for 2 years, and you have to submit 5 cave locations, you know, they've got a standard form because everything's standardized, so they want to keep the standard form. And it doesn't have to be brand new locations. I mean, you can go back to Buckner's Cave or, you know, any cave, just, Keith's kind of the gatekeeper or custodian of the information. And that way it's some of these more obscure caves. If he gets 2 or 3 references, it's a good check, you know, that, this GPS reading is, you know, 600 feet off of the other one, but you know, then he'll make a note of that, you know, not knowing which one's necessarily right. But, so the 5 locations that you have to submit initially can be any you know, new cave, known cave, or ideally more an obscure cave or something that, you know, I mean, Wyandotte or maybe Buckner's wasn't the best example because it's a known, it gets enough visitation that it's not going to move.
Yeah, exactly.
But some of these more obscure entrances have very little or scarce information on them.
The point is that they need the work to be done.
Yeah. And other states have done it too. But like I say, the Indiana, the ICS, they've been around for 25, 30 years, Bill Biles and some of those guys started it years ago and it's just evolved, but there's still a long way to go in documenting all the, and you know, there's a lot of, each county has a director that's responsible for that county. So kind of they're responsible for Monroe County or Washington County or Crawford or whatever to feed the information to.
Hmm.
I don't think a lot of cavers are aware of it, you know, as it could be used as a resource.
Along those same lines, if you do want to get more serious about it and you want to, I mean, I'm sure that the ICS list has caves that don't have a map. Don't have proper locations or photographs of the entrance. And so there's work that needs to be done. And if you can contribute, you'll be revered in the community.
Yeah.
It's work. I mean, money is important, but it seems to me in a lot of areas, it's the work that's more important that needs to be
done. Well, and you know, it's, if you enjoy caving and the whole aspect, it all blends together.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing. So
you can go and have some fun and help somebody out at the same time.
Right.
Then that's perfect.
Yep.
Well, John Benton, thanks so much for being on the Caving Podcast, and thanks for all the work that you've done. And check out the book. Give me the book title again. The Floyd Collins Tragedy at Sand Cave. This is a, what is it? The Arcadia Publishing.
Published by Arcadia Press.
And you've seen, I guarantee you, the listener, have seen books like this. They're the sort of I think it's the Images of America series, right?
I think, yes. Yeah, they publish a lot of, mainly they started in height, like doing towns like Nashville, Indiana, or whatever.
A lot of books of local interest.
Right.
And you did this one on Floyd Collins with, who are your collaborators?
Bill Knapper and Bob Thompson, other cavers from Louisville and Cincinnati.
Just came out in February.
Check it out. Yep.
All right. Thanks, John.
I've enjoyed it. Nice to be here.
There you have it. He was great, wasn't he? I think he knows a lot more than he let on. I could have probably done two or three shows with that guy. Look for it. The Floyd Collins Tragedy at Sand Cave, part of the Images of America series from Arcadia Publishing, out now. Hey, thanks for listening to the Caving Podcast. This podcast has really gotten a lot of listeners, and especially in the caving community, which are the listeners that I want. I couldn't believe how many people heard the Gary Roberson interview last month. It's really picking up, and I do this because I love caving, and I want to promote the NSS and safe caving. So find your local grotto, join it, make some friends, and have fun. As always, support the show by supporting our sponsor, Swago. Visit swagogear.com and load up on chicken loops and other things you might need so he can get those awesome packs back on the market. Next month, I hesitate to mention this because I don't have the interview in the can yet, but I am scheduled to talk to Dick Blends in about a week. Yes, the owner of Storied Buckner Cave, which is now an NSS preserve, the Richard Blends Nature Conservancy. I don't believe in jinxing, but talking about it before it happens is never a good idea, but I'm pretty excited to talk to him. Look for that on the 1st of June. That will be a fascinating interview. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, and until next time, kill nothing but time.